biggest museum in the world. I know, right? It's a trip. How about these planes dangling from the ceilings, huh? Pretty weird.
Hi, excuse me, could you tell me how to get to the Federal Archives?
Of course. Just be a historical document worthy of storing for all eternity. I'm kidding. He's not a document.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and we are not documents. This is Lost in the Stacks, the Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show. I'm Charlie. I'm in the studio with Josh, Matthew, Mirabelle, Toral, Wendy, Fred, and Amit. Do you want to say something, Amit?
Hey, everyone.
Each week on Lost in the Stacks, we pick a theme and then use it to create a mix of music and library talk. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
That's right, Charlie. Today's show is called Things New and Strange. We're going to find out what happens when someone decides to look for the historical and familiar in one of the richest museum and library collections in the world.
And that someone just happens to be Wayne Clough, the former secretary of the Smithsonian, the person who was responsible for all those collections. Oh, and did we mention he was also once president of Georgia Tech?
If you're on campus, the Georgia Tech campus, and you see a building called Clough Undergraduate Learning Commons, that's him.
And I don't know that we've ever interviewed someone who's had a building named after them before.
Dr. Clough also has written a book. It's called Things New and Strange, A Southerner's Journey Through the Smithsonian Collections. We'll ask him how he discovered South Georgia in the halls of a venerable Washington, D.C. institution.
If you want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is Lits440 for Lost in the Stacks, episode 440. Feel free to tweet your thoughts, questions, or your own Smithsonian memories with that hashtag.
And our songs today are all about Georgia, and they're by artists mentioned in our guest's book. This first song, in fact, is by an artist who wrote the Georgia State Song.
Hey.
He grew up in Florida, started performing in Seattle, but he was born in South Georgia. And his first really big hit was recorded right here in Atlanta in the studios of the first Georgia Tech radio station, WGST, for Georgia School of Technology. Wow, way back. From 1954, this is I Got a Woman by Ray Charles, right here on Lost in the Stacks.
Turn that up.
Well, I got... Oh, yeah.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and our guest today is Wayne Clough. He was secretary of the Smithsonian Institute from 2008 to 2014, and he was also president of this fine institution, Georgia Tech, from 1994 to 2008. He's an alumnus as well, and as if that wasn't enough, if you're here on campus, you may recognize his name from the Clough Commons building here in the center of our Midtown Atlanta campus. Dr. Clough, welcome to the show.
Thank you, friend. I'm glad to be here.
So you have just written a book called Things New and Strange, A Southerner's Journey Through the Smithsonian Collections. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. And the book, for folks who haven't had a chance to pick it up yet, it's a bit of an autobiography about your time growing up in South Georgia, kind of focused through the lens of the things that you found in the Smithsonian collection that have some connection to your geographical history and your childhood cultural memories. Why did you want to focus on that particular aspect?
Well, when I was younger, earlier in my life, my career, I ended up, after leaving Georgia Tech, living in California, and I went to University of California, Berkeley, and I majored in geological engineering, and I spent time in the Sierras and the beautiful mountains there and beautiful waters and rivers. I rafted and whitewater rafted with my kids, and I taught at Stanford. I spent a lot of time out there on the ocean and the beautiful shorelines and so forth. And I, at that time, I thought, why would I ever go back to where I was born, which was South Georgia?
All right, it's a long way from South Georgia.
Yeah, small town, flat country, and swamps every place and things of that sort. Over time, I began to rethink that as time went on. And my parents retired. They'd moved away, and they moved back. And I would fly from California to Jacksonville, that's the nearest airport, and then drive for 2 hours up to Douglas, Georgia. And I was all by myself, typically, aside from eating boiled peanuts, which I loved, and I could always get them right outside the airport there. And as I drove through the forest, I thought how beautiful this is, and I'd forgotten about how beautiful it was and how much time as a child I spent in the woods and in the swamps and the ponds fishing and exploring and learning. And I began to realize that I had the wrong thought about South Georgia. It really was a beautiful place.
How old were you when you came to that kind of realization that South Georgia was in your 40s?
In your 40s, yeah. And so I'm at the Smithsonian, and I began to think that it's time for me to write something. My parents had passed away, and I thought I wanted to write something about the place where I grew up. And my family goes back 5 generations in South Georgia, so they have a fairly long history there. And I was a secretary of the Smithsonian, and I realized that while I could write something about my family, that would be pretty narrowly defined. But the Smithsonian had these amazing collections. They have 154.5 million specimens, works of art, and cultural objects. And that somewhere in there I could find something to spice up my narrative.
Right.
I didn't know what I would find or how much I would find, but I thought that would lead me to the subject in a different way. Others had written about the Southern childhood better than I could. And so I began to explore them with the help of the curators, and then eventually took field trips to South Georgia and saw many of the things that I needed to see. And it turned out to be quite an adventure, an amazing story evolved from that.
Did you kind of put this project together throughout your tenure as being Smithsonian Secretary?
No, it was towards the end. And I had, because I did other things when I was there, I think, I wrote a book about the digital future of museums, archives, and libraries, mm-hmm. because I was fascinated by how museums in particular and archives could share their collections with people more than they did. Libraries share, typically, but the archives, many archives and museums, the collections are, you don't see them. And so this would be a way. So I got interested in that part in the initial phase. And towards the middle, I was doing a lot of traveling. The Smithsonian does work in 140 countries. And so I visited some very unusual places, to say the least. I visited all the continents and spent time in the Antarctic at the South Pole because the Smithsonian does work there. So I wrote a book about my travels. But the latter part of my tenure then was directed towards this project. And I started about 2 years before I retired, and it took me about another 4 years to finish it. So this really is a 6-year project.
So you mentioned your interest in making things digitized and making them accessible long term. I want to get to that in a minute, but right now I'm just thinking about the wonder of the physical objects that are in the Smithsonian. And so getting a chance to talk to someone who is the Secretary of the Smithsonian, and for listeners who don't know, the Secretary of the Smithsonian, that's the head honcho of the Smithsonian.
That's one way to describe it.
Right. So being the Secretary of the Smithsonian, I know that a less refined person such as myself, if I found myself in that position, I would just be walking the halls, opening drawers, opening cabinets. Did you ever give into that kind of like exploratory, like I can see it all. I'm just going to wander. I'm going to try on Fonzie's jacket.
Well, you can't wander through the collections. There's always somebody going to be there with you.
Okay.
Because they're called curators.
Right. Yeah.
Because curators.
You don't get a special set of keys that you can just.
No. The curators take care of those items. I said there were 154.4 million things, but every one of those is there forever. Just to give you an example, just take one example. Jefferson, when he was, before he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he designed a desk that could fit in the saddlebag of his horse. It's a very unique desk. And he wrote the Declaration of Independence on that document. And you could open it up and see 2 pages at a time. And the Smithsonian has that desk. Now, I was never allowed to touch it except with white gloves, of course, because you don't want to get your oils in it. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, that's priceless.
Yeah.
And so they don't let you wander around because they don't want anybody to do any damage. They do allow scholars to come in, but they're always accompanied, if you will. But the so, you know, if we're lucky, the Smithsonian will be there 500 years from now, maybe 1,000. And if it should be, Jefferson's writing desk should be there 1,000 years from now. So curators take their job very seriously about how to take care of those objects. But I had a lot of friends. I made it a point of getting to know people. And so wandering around was more to meet the curators. And I travel with them to some of their field sites to see what they were doing, to find out how they got a specimen in the field and how it got back into the Smithsonian, and then how it eventually got into an exhibition and was part of the public display. So being able to go with the curators, and they know where everything is. I mean, you walk into many of these collections, and the lights aren't on. The lights come on when they're motion sensitive,
sure,
because you don't want a lot of light in on a collection. And you're in vast caverns, mm-hmm, of cabinets, mm-hmm, that, you know, have some label that means something to the curator but wouldn't mean anything to you and me.
Right.
And so you're overwhelmed when you're in these collections.
You're listening to Lost in the Stacks, and we'll be back with more from Dr. Wayne Clough about making discoveries in the Smithsonian collections after a music set.
File this set under E173.K87. That was Night Train by James Brown. And before that was On the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe by Johnny Mercer and the Pied Pipers. Those were songs about traveling through geography and history.
Welcome back to Lost in the Stacks. We continue our interview with Dr. Wayne Clough, Secretary Emeritus of the Smithsonian, about, you know what, everyone, I should tell you, you might hear strange noises in the background, but that's because this is a kid-friendly radio show, and you are not allowed to complain about it. We continue our interview with Dr. Wayne Clough, Secretary Emeritus of the Smithsonian, about his experience searching the Smithsonian collections for artifacts that reminded him of his South Georgia home.
So what is the process of discovery like? In your book, like, you go by chapter, you know, things that you found in the geology collection that related to South Georgia, things that you found in the reptile collection, you know, and mm-hmm, such like that. And I get a little sense of that, the kind of wonder that I was getting at. Like one of your quotes in this book that I wrote down is, I walked through aisles bordered by high racks filled with dozens and dozens of bottles and jars containing specimens and fluids. It felt a bit like a stroll through a grocery store. I think that's when you were in the reptile, yeah, collection. And that's, you know, that's right, what I felt like. So what was it actually like going, yeah, through and finding physical objects that related to South Georgia, mm-hmm, you know, for the purposes of this book?
Well, I had help, fortunately, because, sure, I had curators, because if I had walked through those aisles, I would have been a little frightened, perhaps, as a matter of fact, seeing all those eyes looking at you. But Jeremy Jacobs was the curator of reptiles, and he was fantastic. I think he told me I was the first secretary he ever met, so he was really proud that a secretary would come visit his collection. It took me a while to get out of there because Jeremy wanted to show me a lot more than I was there to see.
An enthusiastic curator.
Yeah. But he's fantastic. I mean, and his knowledge base is just immense. And so he was able to show me things from South Georgia very quickly. The largest skin of a snake that they have, of a rattlesnake they have, is from South Georgia. And he pulled it out, and it's in a fluid that keeps it flexible. Mm-hmm. And he pulled it out for me so I could see it, touch it, you know. But I would never have imagined pulling that out of the jar.
And for some of the, you mentioned going on field trips. Like, I think you went on a reptile field trip to South Georgia and found indigo snake habitats. On your family's previous
farm.
Property. Farm, yeah.
Well, the indigo snake, the eastern indigo snake, is a beautiful snake. It's the largest native North American snake, and it's not poisonous. In fact, it eats rattlesnakes, and they sometimes actually get along, and then when the eastern indigo gets hungry, it'll eat a rattlesnake. It's a big snake. It's not as big as the things that have been imported into Florida, but it is, and it's a beautiful snake, the color of indigo. Mm-hmm. Under body is indigo, and it has been decreasing in numbers, in part because loss of habitat, It is a symbiotic species with the longleaf pine, which is a beautiful pine tree. The longleaf pines were massive forest when William Bartram explored South Georgia in the 1700s, but they were cut down for timber, the heart of pine timber. And basically, especially when mechanized capabilities came along, they were cut down enormously. Today, only about 2% of the longleaf pine still exists. And the indigo snake likes the environment created, the acidic soil created by the needles.
Mm-hmm.
It likes that kind of environment, along with the gopher tortoise. They're all, both symbiotic, and they're both endangered because of loss of habitat. And indigo, because people hunted them, because of that beautiful skin.
Mm.
So people are trying to restore them. And in this particular case, I happened to be on a field trip. I wanted to see my grandfather's old farm, which I'd never seen. My father had lived on it, but they had lost the farm, and he never mentioned where it was, and I wanted to see it. And I had a friend who found out where it was in Jeff Davis County on the Okmulgee River. And when I went to see the farm, we stopped at a fence, and the fence talked about the Department of Natural Resources, Georgia, and said this is an area of protected land because of these species, and it's protected because of the indigo snake. So although it's a sad story about my family, for the indigo snake, it's a good story. It's being restored, and longleaf pines are being restored there as well. So it was a nice ending to the story, if you will.
Yeah. Was there, you know...
I did get to hold an indigo snake. The person who was there with me, Dirk Stevenson, is a herpetologist, and he knew he could hold them, and he told me it was a female. I had no idea, as you tell. But I noticed he held a snake real close, and even though it wasn't poisonous, I kind of held it away from me.
Okay. Are they pretty docile, or are they kind of active?
It's a beautiful snake. She was about 6 feet long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wrapped herself around your arm.
Oh, my. That might make me nervous, even though it's not a poisonous snake. I might get a little heart rate going if that happens.
It's a beautiful snake.
You describe in your book also visiting Smithsonian libraries.
Yes.
Now, there's more than one Smithsonian library. There's not like a Smithsonian library. There's more than one.
Yep.
I can't remember the exact number. But you describe going into a particular one that had like a vault and getting some particular volumes out of a vault. Can you talk about the library experience at the Smithsonian? Mm-hmm. Like, who can go in and access those vaults and what's in there?
Okay, well, so the designation is a Smithsonian Institution Library. So it's one of the collecting units at the Smithsonian. There are about 22 collecting units.
Okay.
And so there are 19 museums and galleries. And there are 9 research centers. And so each of those tends to have a small branch library, if you will, related to their particular mission. The one that you're referring to is the main library, and it's in the Natural History Museum. Many people have been to the Natural History Museum on the Mall, which is a beautiful big building, giant building. And on the first floor, and you would never know it's there because it's behind a sort of a facade, is that library. And it has the rare books collection there, and they keep those in a very low temperature to protect the drawings and illustrations that are in those books. Mm-hmm. Some of those books go back hundreds of years.
Libraries are dealing with the shift to digital, and the Smithsonian kind of has been colloquially called America's Attic. is the Smithsonian's mission to be eventually or aiming to be America's digital attic?
Okay. So, well, first of all, it took me a long time to convince people not to use that phrase.
Oh, okay. So that's an outdated term.
Well, the reason is when I was, one of my jobs was to raise money, big money. Like mm-hmm. I was here at Georgia, I'd raise billions of dollars. I had to travel all over the country and convince the Smithsonian was an exciting place where knowledge was being discovered every day.
Okay.
And my conception or belief or thinking about an attic, I grew up as a kid, and I remember going in attics and you had these little streams of sunlight somehow eking through some opening and dust motes floating around in the dust motes, and everything in it was probably ready to be thrown away. But the Smithsonian, on the other hand, is really an exciting place. So it's, we actually had a branding study done, and we're known as Seriously Amazing. Seriously amazing.
Seriously amazing.
Right. But the digital side of it is an important one, and that is because the Smithsonian collections, and particularly things like rare books and so forth, the normal person not going to get to access those. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're a scholar and you have a particular reason to access, you can, because it's a public domain kind of thing. But you got to always have somebody there with you,
right? Because,
and you got to have obviously white gloves to touch any of the delicate parts of anything. Mm-hmm. So digitization is a wonderful tool for a museum like the Smithsonian. For one thing, if you can digitize the collections, it gives access. If people can access a collection they would normally never see. If they did see it, they would have to require special permission, be accompanied to the location. These things have to be pulled out of these massive cabinets and put back in the right place and so forth. Right. And so digitization opens up the collections to everybody. Mm-hmm. It also protects the collections. You don't handle them as much, and you don't misplace them before you put them back. So digitization is a very a positive thing to do in a general way. And so when I was there, we very much emphasized digitization, particularly for access. Again, if you... like bumblebees, there are 66,000 bumblebees at Smithsonian, and those were digitized, and scholars can see these bumblebees in high resolution. And in addition, every bumblebee has two tags on their legs, and one tag tells who collected it and where, and the other says what kind of species it is. So you also digitize the tags, and that gets converted to digital information using a transcription center where volunteers agree to do that for you. So we created the transcription center. Anybody can go work for the Smithsonian. They put up projects every day, and people can go do these. There are people who want to do it. So that makes the process go faster, and it's all public domain information. So, but when you have 154.5 million objects, that takes a long time.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and we'll be back with more from Wayne Clough, former president of Georgia Tech and former secretary of the Smithsonian Institute, on the left side of the hour.
You're listening to Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta.
You believe in WREK?
I believe in WREK.
Today's show is called Things New and Strange. During this mid-show break, we'd like to pause to reflect a little more on how such a vast collection of American artifacts ended up in a place called the Smithsonian in the first place. James Smithson was a well-to-do English scientist who thought that science and education led to the progress of civilization as a whole. He wrote in his notebooks in the early 1800s this motto. And as per use for things of this era, please note that the quote includes gender norms that we're not cool with anymore. Every man is a valuable member of society who, by his observations, researches, and experiments, procures knowledge for men. Okay, James. James Smithson, seeing the promise of progress in science in the still young United States, and how it aligned with his own personal philosophy, decided to make this pronouncement in his last will and testament in 1829. I bequeath the whole of my property to the United States of America to found at Washington, under the name of the Smithsonian Institution, an establishment for the increase and diffusion of knowledge among men. Let's say that among everybody now. From the generosity of a person who never set foot in North America, one of the world's leading scientific, historical, cultural, and artistic institutions was founded. File this set under F291.8.C55. Well, it's Saturday night and I just got paid.
You just heard Travelin' Yodel Blues by Darby and Tarleton. Before that was Black Bottom by Ma Rainey. Before that was Rip It Up by Little Richard. Those were songs about new experiences, learning, and seeing things new and strange.
Today on Lost in the Stacks, we're talking about today on Lost in the Stacks, we're talking about Things New and Strange, A Southerner's Journey Through the Smithsonian Collections, the new book from former Smithsonian Secretary and former Georgia Tech President Wayne Clough.
There's wonderful illustrations in your book, and there's one page that stood out to me. It's when you were looking for birds in South Georgia, and there's an image of, I guess it's the bird collection room, or I don't know what the proper term is. Right. And there's, I don't know, 20, 30 drawers and cabinets open, and you just see hundreds of colorful bird samples. Right. And what stood out to me is all the drawers and cabinets that are closed, and just imagining what's inside all the, and just, you know, and that's when that number 150 or so million items, you begin to think about that and how, and the, and the challenge of that.
660,000 birds.
Oh, wow.
And the head curator is named Carla Dove.
Oh, right. So I can imagine the challenge, as you say, of digitizing that amount, but I can also imagine the rewards of of that coming about, because that's when anyone can kind of do the journey that you did.
Right.
You looked through the collection to see, like, what is in this collection of Smithsonian items that can relate to me and my personal history?
Well, there were about 1 million things digitized, and that doesn't necessarily mean images. That could just be a record of when it was collected.
Okay.
And when I started, and there are about 14 million now. So you still don't have 154.5. But a lot of things normal, the average person is not going to want to look at. They have 19 million worms. How many of those you want to look at?
Zero, I think.
Yeah, right. But there may be scholars who want to use that information. But the other thing that digitizing does, it allows you to connect to other collections.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a collection, let's say of 660,000 birds, that's still not everything.
Right.
And so if other museums have other complementary collections, you can put them together. And so you can do it much more easily than digitally than you would do it otherwise.
I have a quick-ish question about how the curator role might change as you move to more of a digital collection, because I could see how that gives a lot more access, but I can also see the role of a curator being the one who knows how to direct you to the information that matters most, where just using a search bar may not fill that. So just how that role changes when you don't have someone next to you showing you physical objects.
That's a very good question, Emmy. And we're in the early stages of this, really. The museums that have made the most progress in digitizing are the art museum, because their collections usually aren't that large. And if you have 40,000 works of art, that's a huge art collection. It's not a huge natural history collection. I mean, I've got 66,000 bumblebees alone just to get started, or 19 million worms. But in a way, the curator becomes more important, because even though you or I could look at this, just say 66,000 bumblebees, we're going to get lost. And the curator understands how all these things come together and how the collections work together. So in a way, a curator becomes more important, but their role kind of changes. They become more of an external person, less than an internal person. And so we're still sorting through this, how you do this. Now, I will say that Ashok Gale in your computer science department, Dr. Gale, is working with the Smithsonian on an AI technique to search the collection. So there are a number of places where the digitization has gone ahead at a fast pace. And one of these, incidentally, is the Biodiversity Heritage Library, BHL. Mm-hmm. And the Biodiversity Diversity Library is a work by about 15 different organizations. The Smithsonian is the lead, but organizations all over the world contribute their time and resources to it. The idea is to take all the classical biodiversity books, let's just say Darwin's journals, and digitize all those. It turns out Darwin's journals are in 15 different locations. But if they're all digitized, you and I can see Darwin's actual journals that he recorded his notes in. And they've made tremendous progress by working together. So libraries working together is an important part of that. So we're just beginning to learn how these things go. Now, Ashok's work is with the Encyclopedia of Life. And so the Smithsonian has two very interesting global kind of efforts. And one is called the Barcode of Life. And the idea there is to take a piece of your genomics information, enough of it to identify you as a species. You don't have to have the whole thing. And put that into a digital record. So every species, there are probably 2 million plus known species, or probably 20 million, you know, things in the ground that we don't know about. And then there's the thing called Encyclopedia of Life, which is was an effort by the Smithsonian to have a web page for every species on Earth, so over 2 million web pages for every species. And a lot of that was citizen science. People would contribute their own information, so it was a very interesting process. But once you've got that, it's overwhelming. You know, 2 million, where do you start? And I want to know something about what's in my backyard, as an example. I don't know where to start, right? And so basically Ashok is working with the Smithsonian, so you can ask a question to an agent, artificial intelligence agent, and that agent will understand what you're looking for. And it will begin to assemble things across these boundaries and give them to you. And you can say, no, I didn't quite mean that. I meant this. And it will do that. So I think that's another place where digitization is going to be so important, and curators will be important, because they will inform this process of helping us. They don't really want to answer the question from every person who has a question. They can't do it. It's impossible. But this artificial intelligence agent can do it for you, an Alexa kind of person, can actually help you go through the collections and find things that you want.
So Alexa or Siri is going to be my research assistant.
Could be.
For a research project at the Smithsonian.
Yep. Oh, but gosh. It's part and parcel of the digitization process.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
The Smithsonian is going to become seriously amazing in digitization.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and we've been joined today by Dr. Wayne Clough. He is President Emeritus of Georgia Tech, former Secretary of the Smithsonian, and author of the book Things New and Strange, A Southerner's Journey Through the Smithsonian Collection. Dr. Clough, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Petra. It's been a pleasure to be here.
File this set under BF371.K36. You have been listening to a jam, which was called In Memory of Elizabeth Reed by the Allman Brothers Band. That was a song about keeping the past with you.
Today's show was called Things New and Strange, about Wayne Clough's exploration of the Smithsonian collections and the things he found that reminded him of home.
The Smithsonian is emphatically not America's attic. It is a living collection, representative of a rich culture of our history, art, and scientific discovery.
Within its many halls, there is always more to be found, more to be represented, more to be included, and more knowledge to be discovered.
From things old and familiar to things new and strange.
Nice. Let's roll those credits. I don't know if we have any Georgia artists in the credit rotation, but do we have something that's maybe like Georgia adjacent? Oh, dude, be careful with that one.
Look out!
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library, produced by Charlie Bennett, Amit Doshi, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Rasko.
Josh was our engineer today, and
Hey-o.
The show was brought to you by The Collective, supporting new and innovative librarianship since 2014, including the League of Awesome Librarians. Find out more at thelibrarycollective.org.
Legal counsel and a mixtape for our road trip to Coffee County. You guys
I'm
are coming, right?
Right now.
It is provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Dr. Clough for being on the show. And thank you, as always, to each and every one of you for listening and calling it the Clough, not the Kulk.
Find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and plenty of other places we don't even know about.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, how to write a book chapter. Some librarians are going to break it down for us.
It's time for our last song today, and it's a song about a person that leaves his Georgia home to live in Northern California, but longs for home and the good memories there, not unlike the journey that Wayne Clough took in his career. This is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Georgia's own Otis Redding, right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everyone.